For those that are watching the recorded version, sorry about the lower quality audio for the first section that we were just covering. Hopefully this will sound a little bit better. So you take a transformation from an existing RDD. So a transformation is basically some operation that's on an immutable object that results in another immutable object that still resides on the cluster. So it's something that you may or may not be interrogating completely for information. That's why it can sit in this transform state rather than having to sort of be reduced into something that sits on the driver that you can actually inspect. So once it's on the cluster, you it's really kind of an abstraction. We'll talk a little bit about transformations and actions in a moment. And then again, if I didn't make this clear before, I just do want to emphasize how rich the file system support is now. It just really supports almost every kind of. And when you're deciding on file types, if you have the option to choose a file type, pick Parquet if you can, because there's a lot of support for Parquet. There's also this other streaming, in-memory columnar format called Arrow, which is kind of part of the Parquet ecosystem. And all of it supports this, query pushdown, things that are very, very clever ways of loading your files. And probably there's ORC, which is the Hive format, which is also very good. But just as a heads up, just carry this forward, as if you get a chance to make a choice on file formats, try to choose Parquet, because it will make a huge difference. And we've seen significant changes, and people get locked into file formats early on. That's why we try to, suggest that before they make those kinds of decisions. But all of them are supported. Yeah.
So you prefer Parquet over Escort because the file format is better, or Escort has better support?
Actually, between Parquet and ORC, it's kind of a toss-up. Parquet has a little bit more support, but ORC and Parquet are both columnar, and they both support pushdown in the queries. So pushdown is something where if you filter something, it will only load. It will take the filter, the where statement in your SQL statement, and will push that all the way down to the file loading part. And so it will only load portions of that file that meet the query requirements, which can make vast improvements in file and performance. And so ORC and Parquet both support pushdown, but others like Avro doesn't, for example. So that'll make a huge difference. When you're loading things, but in terms of like ORC versus Parquet, it's kind of a toss-up. But yeah, one of those two is usually the preferred format if you can. So just a discussion of what a transformation is versus what an action is. A transformation always produces a new RDD. Which just means it's this sort of it's this thing that's residing in the cluster that you may not have access to the full information yet, and when you do another operation to it that doesn't require that you know the contents, it'll just create another RDD for you. So it's just a roadmap of operations basically, and the important thing is it's a lazy evaluation. So you say I want to add one to it, I want to subtract one to it, I want to do this and that and this and the other thing. It'll say, okay, I'll do that whenever you decide to ask me what the actual answer is, right? Because at the end of the day, you may filter it down to where there's only one number that they have to do an operation on. In principle, it can optimize for all that stuff beforehand, and then when you actually ask for the answer, which is an action, then it can create an execution plan that makes it an efficient calculation.
Are the transformations like also transduced? They get applied one at a time as you need them. So if you ask for like these five transformations in a row, and uh-huh. you ask for only a certain number of elements, the first 10 or something, is it only running like one item through all five pipelines as the second item, or does it like then just run the whole pipeline? Because this is the source data. If you ask for 10 items, I got to run the transformations.
Right. So it does. So a transformation never returns an actual answer. It just returns kind of a roadmap. Like you say, like, oh, I want to add one to it. It'll say, oh, you loaded this file. You wanted to add one to it. Then you wanted to subtract one to it. And then it doesn't actually return an answer. It just returns this roadmap of instructions. And then you say, oh, give me the top five. The top, when you say take five, remember that take five operation? Take five is actually an action because now it pulls down those numbers, returns those answers to the driver. So it takes the numbers off of the cluster, does a calculation, returns the answers to the driver. That's when it actually does a calculation. And I think if you were asking, does it actually, you know, it would only do the operation on those five numbers that you asked for rather than the entire thing. And so, you know, every generation of Spark has a more sophisticated way of evaluating those execution plans and making the right calls. Like for example, I don't know if it knows that if you add one and then subtract one to every element, does it know that it doesn't need to do that operation? But in principle, it should, right? It should be able to optimize for all that kind of stuff. But the takes and things like that are definitely ones that they have optimized for. So, and there's also something called the data frames engine, which is an SQL engine, which really does do like really complex query optimization, and we'll talk a little bit about that. And that one really has some sophisticated stuff in it. So, so transformations are things that just create new RDDs, just kind of create and when they say when you say RDD, it's basically data source plus something called a directed acyclic graph or data source plus map of operations, right? That's really what an RDD is. It actually doesn't even load the file when you create it. So it doesn't load the file until you actually ask for the answer with an action. So that's another thing to when you're coding, you'll say, "Oh wow, look how fast it loaded this terabyte data set," right? It says load this, right? And they're like, "Oh, that only took, you know, half a second or half of a millisecond." And then you say, add one to it and give me the answer, and then it takes, you know. So then that's when it's doing the actual calculation. So it's good to know how this thing is working when you're starting to time things out. It can be kind of tricky to time these things, actually, because of that. So this is, you know, what I mentioned was the directed acyclic graph is the DAG. And it's not evaluated until you do the action. So I think we covered most of this stuff. But you know, just to kind of reiterate the resilience part of this, when a node goes down, the DAG itself is replicated, which carries the roadmap of operations, and so that's how it gets the resilient part of it. And so this abstraction is called, you know, the resilient distributed data set, right? So that's why that's such an important thing. And so this was the really big revolutionary idea in Spark was the creation of this object, and you know, then everything builds upon this basic idea. So this has a lot of stuff that you're kind of used to seeing now from collections. It's got a map, it's got a filter, it's got distinct, it's got flat map, it's got all these operations that we were doing on standard arrays, so it looks very similar. These are all transformations, though, right? These will just result in another RDD because it doesn't give you a result. Make sense? Okay, so actions reduces an action, right? Because now it has to give you a number. Take is an action because it gives you a local array. So the output of take is no longer an RDD. It's a Scala array. Collect will take your terabyte of stuff and try to put it on the driver. So be careful when you're using this one, unless you're debugging and your distributed array is actually maybe only a few kilobytes or something, because it will break your driver. And then some other, you know, more fancier ones where you take an ordered array and things like that. So okay, so we will do we'll do this one in PySpark. Oh, let's do. And let's do this. So if you're following along on the slides, I don't know if I mentioned this, but the code, the usually all, anytime I refer to code, it'll tell you the name of the file, and it's in code examples. So if you want to run these along, you should be able to find them that way. But let me know if you're trying to run them and you can't. I'm just going to create another shell here to run PySpark. So to run PySpark, it's pretty much the same thing, except for instead of Spark Shell, it's just PySpark. And what it will do is if you have Python 2.7 installed natively, it'll open up a Python shell, initialize Spark context, and run it in that version. So you have 2.7, you'll get Python 2.7. If you have Python 3, you'll get Python 3 here. So the Spark shell will look for the Scala installation that's native to the Spark binary, but the Python, it'll just pull the whatever version of Python you're running off of your system. Just as a heads up, just in case if you try to run this in Python 3 and there's some, you know, Python 2 and Python 3 have some differences in syntax. So, and I think it's what, exec file? How does it? Is that it? Okay. There's a typo somewhere in here. Okay. So let's talk about what's happening here before. So we created this data, which is a local object. That's the XRange object. And then we parallelized it and we created XRange RDD. Okay, so this is what it looks like in Python. It tells you what's going on. It says Python RDD at RDD, Python RDD. It just tells you the class that it's using to create this. So notice, if you remember before, we were talking about how you kind of do this type safety thing, and this is kind of what you're doing here. You're saying, I'm basically taking the same data and then I'm making an RDD out of it, and I'm kind of annotating it that way because it's Python. I don't have type safety and all that kind of stuff. So you'll see that in the code, and it's I don't know. I don't know if it's exactly good practice, but that's you'll definitely see it a lot. And now we just did this subtracted RDD. And so now the Python code looks pretty much the same as the Spark code. You could almost, you know, copy and paste these things and just make a few tweaks here and there, really. There's not much difference between, as long as you're not doing anything super fancy, the Spark code and the PySpark code look pretty much the same. So so you take this RDD, it has a map function because it's an RDD. These have pretty much the same methods available in PySpark and Scala. And then instead of x forward arrow x minus 1, we do this lambda x colon x minus 1. That's the only difference in terms of the lambda expression syntax. And then we've got a filter, and same thing. We still have a lambda expression. Let me just show you what it looks like in Scala. Okay, so really just, you know, the data is created a little bit differently, but everything else is pretty much the same. This comma here is, I asked it to create, I gave it a specific instruction to create four partitions. It'll create, so partitions are just, you know, places where it carves up the data and has it sit on the cluster somewhere. Most of the time, the partitioning is handled by the file system, so it tries to load the file partition into a Spark partition, so that you have this one-to-one mapping. But you know, you can explicitly ask for different partitioning. So that's what that is. So it all looks pretty much the same, right? So then we've got filtered RDD collect. So the sub-RDD is also an RDD. Filtered RDD is also an RDD. And then filtered RDD collect is now just a Python array, right? And then count is just an integer. Okay, so let's try this one over here. And once you get into Spark world, the Scala and the Spark APIs, or Python APIs, look very, very similar, and then the Scala and Python APIs in the local version are a little bit more divergent. So, same idea here. Now you have filtered RDD. Collect. And now it's an array of integers. And so it'll tell you that it's returning an array of integers. So, okay. And then we can take a look at, let's see, we'll open up localhost. Now that we've created the, we'll go over here. Okay, so this is the Spark UI, and when you spin up the Spark context, it will tell you what port it's gonna put it on. Most of the time it's 4040, and then this one is probably 4041 because it. Let's see. Yeah. So because I have two contexts running on the same computer, it says, hey, I tried to open this on 4040, but something's going on. I'm going to try it on 4041, right? So we'll just go through. So we're looking at the Scala version of this. And it's been up a couple hours because I haven't turned it off since earlier on. So then you've got the jobs, and then, okay, so what it's doing now is it's saying, all right, so the action that you gave me was count. So I'm gonna report count as, but that count, you know, count is, it's the action that is at the tail end of all of those operations that led up to it. So if I loaded the file, I did a bunch of other stuff, all that stuff would happen when I hit that count operation. So that, when it says count, it's not just counting, it's doing a bunch of other stuff too. So you can visualize the DAG. So it's got some stuff here where it does the map partitions, and this is not the, of course, this is not the fanciest thing that we could think of doing. So we'll have some richer DAGs to look at here in a minute. But so then we got this. All right, so let's just jump back and try to figure out what we just did. My PowerPoint. Ah, did it put my browser on the same thing? Let's do that. Okay. So what do we just do? We created an RDD. We broke it up into four partitions. Remember, I said that comma, the four partitions part. Broke it up into four partitions. This may or may not be the best way to do it. You know, it's got some stuff, you know, it seems to think that this is the best way to parse this up. I mean, a lot of times this is determined mostly by the file system, the way the file system partitions things up. Very rarely that you're going to create a parallel construct like that from your driver unless you're doing some generative process, right? Because it's going to be much, it's never going to be, it's always going to be too big to fit on your driver realistically unless you're doing something fancy. But most of the time the file system is determining this. But let's say you create your data set, you break it up into four partitions, and each of these partitions is sitting somewhere on your cluster, right? And so these partitions are here, they all have access. And these are the worker nodes that are operating on that shared memory, right? They're just accessing the memory and then running the calculation. And then you run a map and this is parallel. This is your parallel operation, right? Now you're crunching the numbers in parallel, which is, you know, the whole point of doing this on the cluster, right? So each worker gets assigned some chunk of the calculation, but again, this is just a map operation, so this isn't happening actually. It just says, oh, this partition, I'm going to take this partition, you know, when the time comes, just in case I need to do this calculation, this is how I'm going to do it, right? So it takes, again, just this map operation just takes, you know, even on a cluster, it will take less than a second to carry out because it's just storing the instructions. And then filter, now it's doing some fancier stuff now. Now it's starting to figure out, you know, what parts are going to just completely disappear from the calculation, right? And then it keeps those, the operation, and then finally collect. So, yeah, this one, the filter part didn't, this collect actually didn't happen on the filtered stuff. It happened on the previous one. But this really is just to bring home the fact that you don't want to do collect on your actual large-scale data set, right? Because it'll all land on your driver. And then count. So, I mean, it, you know, reduce has this kind of stuff. All these other ones have this kind of stuff where it does some summary calculation on each node, and then those summary calculations are carried out, and then those summaries are summarized, and, you know, reduce has that that flavor too. So, and then all that stuff lands on the driver with just this one number that's that the driver can handle. So, there are ways of persisting the memory. And you know, as you use the higher level APIs, like for example the data frames API, the persistence is handled as part of the execution plan. But here, if you're writing your own RDD based operations, you want to persist manually. And these are the ways to do it. You can do it just in memory, memory and disk, serialized, memory and disk serialized, and then some of these other fancier ones are. I mean, the ones you see is like memory only and then memory and disk. And what it'll allow you to do is if you blow out your cluster memory, it will spill to disk. And then you'll take a performance hit, but you won't break your program. Whereas if you run out of memory, it will stop the calculation. So the big, the really big thing to worry about, and we'll take a look at this for the cached example, is that when you cache your data, it's going to put all of your data in memory. That's a lazy operation. So the first time you cache it, it's going to say, oh, okay, so he wants to cache it. Then you run an operation, and then you run the operation as part of that transformation operation. Let's say you finally filtered or collect on it or something like that. That's when it caches the data. So the first time you pass through that data, you're not getting the benefit of the caching. So if you're doing some kind of standard ETL thing, like you load something, you crunch some numbers, and then you write it, you're going to get zero benefit from caching because it's only going to you're just pulling data in and you're doing stuff and then you're writing it and you're not accessing that data multiple times. In order for you to get the real benefit, it's something you load, you put it into memory, and then you access it multiple, you query it a few times, you know, or you take the same table and you have different questions or optimization, right? If you're computing the same objective function multiple times, then that's when you get the benefit of the memory access. So it's just a heads up, things to remember. And the other thing to remember is make sure your cached RDD actually fits on your cluster before you start, try to get that calculation in hand before you jump into this project of saying I'm going to get 10x, 100x speed from in-memory calculation, because the claim is, you know, typically an in-memory read, it can be upwards of 100 times faster, sometimes 1,000 times faster, but there's a whole host of other engineering considerations to think about as you're moving forward. So just sometimes that 10x improvement doesn't just come as easily as you may think. So make sure you scale out the cluster correctly, and we'll show you how to take a look at where the data is residing and how much is actually cached. So because we've seen that before where you didn't spec out the cluster quite correctly, and you don't have enough memory, and you're basically just dealing with reading and writing from disk. So, so I'm going to show you the cache example. Okay, so just to walk through what the code's doing here. Okay, so, how about if we do that? How about if we, this has happened before where I've done entire examples without escaping so you can see the code. Please let me know if I'm out of sync with what's happening on the screen. Yeah.
Yeah, sorry about the previous. Is this a proper saying about the memory only, or can you define that by an RDB?
Mm-hmm.
Basically, you have two types of data normally, no? The data that comes from the that you need to work on,
mm-hmm.
and the data that you need say, for aggregation.
Mm-hmm.
And the aggregation data is good to have it on memory.
Yes. Yeah. So, I mean, the rule of thumb for caching is if you think you're going to have to access that data multiple times, that's the thing. So, if you have, let's say you have one table, and you have three different tables, you want to join table one on the main table, table two on the main table, table three on the main table, then cache that main table, right? Because it's constantly being accessed. Or if you have, but if you're just doing, there are a lot of times where you just load two tables, you aggregate them, you write them.
But like you have the source there, and like one common is to find who's the customer associated with the data.
Uh-huh.
So you have to load the customer tables.
Yeah.
As RDB source.
Yeah.
And that is actually persistent and actually cache, because sometimes that data is a lot of records.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So I would say you're talking about maybe almost like a server framework where you have one table that's kind of a cached and
metadata,
right, and then you've got like lots of people querying it and things like that. Is that the idea?
So you need to work for each record to find who the customer is, like, for example, from that record to the
data. Uh huh. Yeah, so if you want to have something like we have a server framework, I mean, Spark is not quite like, you know, if you have multiple people querying the same table, it's probably better to actually populate an actual database that's better for multi-tenant. So you can do a whole series of operations in Spark and then have it sit in, a faster serving framework that supports multi-tenant, even HBase, or well, it depends on how you want to do it, or if you want to have it in a regular SQL database. So in terms of like system setups like that, that might be the better way to do it. For Spark, it's usually caching is usually some kind of clever way of leveraging what data you need at what point in the calculation. So it tends to be more of an ETL framework in that sense. So it's a matter of just that how you construct that ETL pipeline in a way that is most optimal. You'll tend to see Spark sitting in the workflow, in the sort of the larger workflow is we've got this way of loading data, or we've got this unstructured data, and then we've got this server framework, or we've got this streaming data, and then we've got this other framework, and we've got some really hard calculation that sits in the middle of it, like some really difficult aggregation or some really tough calculation that we can't figure out how to do in any other framework, but we can in Spark because we can write low-level Scala code if we need to get it to crunch through that number. And so you'll see that a lot because they'll have these like high-performance frameworks handling all of the other stuff, and then the Spark is doing some part that's just really tricky. And so that's usually where you see it. So, yeah, I'll have some clever thoughts about caching usually in that part. I don't know if that was helpful or...
The...
Yeah, let me show you. I'll show you what it looks like, and then we can take a look. So I'll walk through this example, and then I'll show you what the how to check for caching in the Spark UI, and then we can come back to your question and see if that helped. Okay. That's correct. Yes. So caching is a Spark operation, which means it has to be on essentially something that's accessible through the Spark context. So the most basic abstraction is the RDD. There are other ones like it. There's like a data frame, and then there's a data set and other things, but they're all built on the RDD. Yeah, cache is like the one that says, yeah, put it in memory. And then there's the more general one is persist. It's dot persist is the method, and then you can say memory only, and then or others like that. So cache is the same as persist, memory only. So yeah. So let's take a quick peek at what's happening here, and then we can go to the Spark UI. So this is we're just parallelizing this array. And this is one of those things that I believe you can, it works like a generator, I think. You just, it'll create it without blowing out memory. But we created 50 partitions. We cached it. Then we timed the first count. And then we counted it again to time the second count. So what we got was the delta T for the first count was 0.3. And the delta T for the second count was 0.2, which seems like a very unspectacular improvement. And the reason for that is because there's some latency between calculating the result and shipping it back to the driver, and that's washing out the difference in calculation time. So I'm going to bring up the Spark UI, and you can see the difference in calculation time there. So we'll go back here. Okay, so the first count took 0.1 second. These are the two counts that we just ran. First count took 0.1 second. The second count took 50 milliseconds. So the first count actually went through the entire data set, counted it, and also cached it, right? So you've got the time investment in caching it as part of that calculation. The second one just did the operation on the cached data, which is why it's 50 milliseconds. So all that difference in time is the latency of it basically shipping the result from the executor back to the driver. So you'll see that, just because we're working with this kind of, in this mini system that we're getting this weird latency, but you get significant improvements when you cache the data, right? So it's definitely worth trying to do. So then you can take a look at your storage, and this is the one that's gonna tell you whether you've got the right size cluster or not, is you cache your data, it'll tell you the number of partitions that are cached, the fraction cached, which should be 100%, right? If it's not 100%, then you're reading from disk to do part of your operations. So then the size in memory and the size on disk. So this is the one that you can use to tune your cluster to make sure it's performing. That's right. Cache is a transformation. So caching in and of itself does not trigger any kind of calculation, including caching. So yeah, you have to do a count to get it to, or some other action. Sometimes you almost need to access the data twice to get before you get the improvement, because the second time you don't actually carry out an action until you're accessing it the second time or something like that. So it's always something to keep an eye out for. The timing is tricky. You always have to be aware of what's actually being run in the intervals of time between, you know, the time that you create the DAG and then you don't know, does it include the file loading, or if you carried out an action after you loaded the file to create a new RDD, you know, what part of the loading, where's the timing, you know. So sometimes it can be tricky to parse out what's happening in which section of it. And sometimes you actually have to load it. I mean, you actually have to run them in separate chunks if you really want to home in on the timing. But you should be able to see improvements in the calculation through this, through the UI. So, yeah. All right. Okay. Cool. All right. What time are we going to? Are we going till 12? 12:50. Oh, okay. Cool. We got time. All right. So, talk a little bit about come back to the Spark ecosystem. What time are we going till? 1:10. Oh, okay. Cool. Okay. Okay.
It says 11:20 for 100 minutes.
Okay. So those exactly one. Okay, cool. So we got time. Okay. So Spark ecosystem. Talked a little bit about these guys here. These are the main libraries that are accessible. This is the one I think that never gets enough attention, and it's like by far the most useful library. It's just like another just layer of API to Spark that really gives it a lot of power, really. I mean, you can do a lot of stuff. So it's the Spark module as it acts as the distributed. Oh, let's get this back on. It's the distributed SQL query engine. So you create your data frame, and then you can run SQL commands on it. How many people are fans of SQL or at least familiar with SQL? Kind of half? Oh, okay. All right, okay. So, yeah, I mean, if you get used to it, like, there's just certain things that, like, it's just so much easier to do SQL than anything else, right? So you can run SQL-like queries. Again, it supports all these formats. This is the part that, once you get into the data frame API, this is the part where you can leverage the query pushdown that I was talking about. So it kind of has to be in this data frame API for you to leverage all of that. It combines SQL with the programming API, does ETL, then ad hoc query, and all that kind of stuff. And then it has two components. It's got the data frame, which is this distributed collection of data. And basically, it takes an RDD, and then it adds some metadata and says, hey, this is now a table. And then it's got a schema, and then you can do all the stuff that you can do with SQL. It also creates a thing called the SQL context, which you have to have access to in order for it to work. So. This is really handy, and the thing that is also really useful about this, yeah, we don't have that, is this is the one place where it, not in all cases, but in many cases, the performance of the PySpark API is almost equivalent to the Scala API. So you can get pretty far if you have a strong preference for using PySpark. You can get this in the DataFrames API, you can expect pretty good performance. There's a few places with the UDFs and things like that where it's kind of clunky, but it's very good for that. So you can get very, very far with the PySpark API in this case. So it basically compiles down to the same bytecode. Takes the execution plan from both and it compiles it down, and then it runs the execution plan on the clusters. So we'll go to I'm gonna go to DataFrames example here. Okay. Okay, so sure exactly what's going on there. Okay, so basically we've got, let's take a look at what the... This is just a simple JSON file. So it loads the JSON file into a data frame. And so if you look at df, it's going to tell you, hey, this is a data frame. This data frame has this array. This is the schema. Age is big int. Name is string. And it also inferred the schema automatically in this case. So some file formats contain schemas, some don't. Parquet, ORC, you know, the big fancy ones contain schemas. But something like JSON, CSV doesn't necessarily have a schema, so we'll infer the schema just at load time. And it doesn't have to have all the fields. You know, it has, you know, all the kind of higher level stuff that you would kind of expect from a, yeah. Okay, that's a good question. So in general, I would say it, and we touched on this a little bit, it's a something that loads maybe unstructured. You can load it from anywhere. It doesn't have to be from an unstructured data source. But you're loading some kind of complex data set that needs to be aggregated and summarized and calculated on. And Spark is good at that. You know, pull data from disparate sources, pull in unstructured data, do all that kind of stuff. Crunch it all together, you know, kind of stuff you would expect to do with MapReduce mostly. To that end, you know, you can do something like join, for example, in MapReduce, right? Or in Spark, you could also write low-level Spark code to do a join. Or you could load that data in, populate a data frame. And now, instead of writing join in low-level code, you can write join with SQL. Right, so you can still do a lot of your aggregations, but you're going to do much more complex aggregations now because you've got this SQL language available for that. No, in fact, the more you push on the SQL engine, the better your performance will get because the SQL engine is optimized. And in fact, IBM pulled all of our DB2 people off of their projects to work on Spark projects, so it's got all this really heavy-duty stuff in there, and it's got some other folks that were working pretty hard on it. So the SQL engine's really good. So you can write a join in like Spark, you know, which is like the RDD and the key value stuff, and have it do a join. And then if you run it in the SQL engine, it will run faster, much faster in many cases. So yeah, the idea is to try to just push everything into a data frame and then try to work in that data frame space if you can. But it's still kind of, like you were saying, in that kind of space, it still kind of fits in that ETL complex calculation and summarization part. And then it lands somewhere where you have like maybe a higher, like a server framework that can support multi-tenant queries and things like that. That, for example, HBase or some big table thing that serves a bunch of queries. You know, Spark isn't so good for that kind of stuff. It doesn't have that multi-tenancy stuff built into it. But it's really good at crunching all those numbers to get it to that point. So, but yeah, so the data frames is kind of a tool for accomplishing that rather than maybe a server framework that maybe the fact that it's SQL might make you think that it would be good for that, but that's not quite what it does. Yeah. Does that make sense? Can I answer any more questions on that? Yeah.
Does it have its own SQL execution engine and query optimizer?
Yeah, it has something called the Catalyst engine. And that has pieces of query optimization that have been, you know, IBM's been doing it since the 70s. Some other companies have been at it for a while. So it's got lots of, you know, standard query optimizations, things like push down, things like, you know, you rewrite the queries, if, you know, if the where comes before the select, it knows, you know, all this kind of stuff, really complicated stuff. And that's all in there at this point. Yeah, most of it got in there by Spark 2, so it became a very mature, and now I think it's pretty much stabilized, so I think most of this stuff is in there now. So, and then there's another one, there's another SQL engine that operates on streaming. I don't have examples for that, but that's called structured streaming. So that also supports SQL queries as well. So yeah, it's pretty cool. So yeah, it's, the big take home is yes, try to use this as much as possible because it will be, you'll get better performance out of it. So it's good to know like all of the low-level stuff because there's still cases where you need to write that kind of code. But for there's so many cases where, you know, a well-written SQL statement will handle most of what you need to do that that's probably the best way to go. Yeah.
So Hive also supports Spark and
Yeah, I can't remember. There's some connector between Hive and Spark that people like to use. Maybe just because I come from the Spark Technology Center, I'm going to say use Spark as your center of mass. And I even somebody was talking to me today, oh, I got a bunch of Java. I'm like, oh, well, open up a Scala prompt, import your Java library, you know. So I tend to think that everything can be solved from the Spark shell prompt, right? And in many cases, that's true. I mean, for example, Hive, the underlying format for Hive is ORC, right? And so you can just load ORC directly into Spark and operate that way. But there are connectors. There's other ways of connecting it that are, you know, depending on how your ecosystem is set up, you know, you may have to run things from Hive. I don't know too much about how to launch Spark from within Hive. Oh, okay. That's right, yeah, because it used to only support the Hive query language, which was a subset of SQL, and now Spark supports almost the full ANSI-compliant SQL set. So, yeah, if Hive could connect to that, then it would be able to just, you know, transparently support a fuller query language. So, yeah, I mean, if you're used to, I can try to find out more about it if you've got some, you know, configuration questions, and yeah, just send us a note and we'll see if we can figure it out. But yeah, in general, the way I've always done it is I always start from Spark and try to work everything from there. So yeah. Yeah, no, UDFs are actually pretty easy in Spark, surprisingly. But they're easier in Scala. That's the one place to a bit of a heads up on the PySpark APIs, the UDFs in PySpark. They're faster than they used to be because they use Arrow, but they're still not as fast as the native Scala version of it. So yeah, if you're using UDFs extensively, that's one case maybe Scala might be recommended over PySpark. But they are very, like you said, very straightforward to write. And we've had this thing where we've had teams trying to write their UDFs in Java and compile them and yada yada, and I'm like, you know, a few lines of Scala and we're off to the races, and it makes a huge difference. Yeah. So. This is just some of the syntax for creating this stuff. I mean, it loads it into a data frame, and then data frame has all these kind of standard things. Df.show, and then it you know, kind of looks like you would expect it to look in a SQL environment, print schema. gives you the same kind of stuff that you normally would see. In order to create a table that you can query using an SQL string, you just do this, whatever they call it, create temp view, and then just name your table there. And then your, so let me jump to this SQL statement before I talk about this one. This is your SQL, you just say spark.sql, and then just send in a string. The string is that will then be processed by the Catalyst engine, and then it'll run the query. It'll return a data frame, which is a transformed object, and then so to actually carry out the query, you do a show, and that'll run an action on it. If you don't want to bother with this create temp view and running SQL, there's this method-based query language that is exactly identical. It calls the Catalyst query in the same way. So there's no, in terms of, on the machinery side of it, there's no difference. It's just whether you prefer the syntax or not. You can do df select and then just name the column and select it that way. So totally your preference, but they're both available to you. There's also some other kinds of, I can't remember where this comes from, maybe R or something like that, this dollar sign notation. I don't know, but some people seem to like it. People like it enough that it appeared in the API. So there's other ways of filter is your filter on where age is greater than 21. And you can see why these are preferred now. I mean, they're just more compact, but I still actually like this syntax. It's more legible. There's a few reasons why you don't necessarily want to use SQL because this actually is not exactly type safe, right? This is this doesn't enforce type safety at compile time, whereas this does. So that's about the only real difference. It's entirely your preference. And then we've got a group by here. Same thing. You can access it with a method, or you can do the count. Just do counts and group bys and do all that kind of stuff that you do normally with SQL.
Can you do update?
Yeah. I don't know that one. Is that SQL or? You mean when I add to the tables and things like that? Yes. Yes, you can. I don't know if you can do it from SQL. I haven't tried that one.
You cannot do it from
a table. So what you can do is you can create a new data frame that has extra data added to it. I don't know if it's you use update or not, but you can. That's right. It has to create a new one. You basically create a new data frame. And a lot of times what I've done before is I create a data frame and then I want to append to it. I just do, I basically do a +++, which is a union, and then they add them both together and then that creates a new data frame. And then you can resort it or do whatever you need to do. But there's ways of doing it. Once you create the data frame, you can still add to it. You can add columns and things like that too. So there's it's pretty robust at this point. It's you'll find that you could probably do things you can't do in a regular SQL engine because of the fact that you can always drop down to the lower level Scala code and fiddle with it and get it to do what you're trying to get to do. So yes. Yeah. You're always creating a new data frame when you do it, but it still is efficient. You can do all kinds of stuff like that. Creating columns is actually kind of tricky, but it's definitely doable. So.
Okay.
Yeah.
You mentioned that with that syntax there will be type safety check, but the type of the data frame or the type of the columns is actually determined at runtime, right? When you read the JSON file.
Uh huh.
Right.
That's a good point. It may not be all. Yeah, it could be. That's a good point. You can define the schema. When you create a data, normally when you create a data frame, remember when we were talking about case classes? So when you define the data frame, you define the schema with the case class. And in that case, all the types are laid out in the code, and then you can check all that stuff. But yeah, you're right. A lot of times you lose a little bit of type safety in general on this. I mean, for me, I actually prefer writing in the SQL, and you're completely abandoning type safety there anyway. So that's a good point. Because even in Parquet, where the schema is defined in the file, it's not defined in the code, so it doesn't catch it at compile time. So
you could flag the read to not infer the schema when you read.
Ah, okay. And then you assign with case class. Yeah.
Your case class to read using your schema instead of the inference or something like that.
Yeah, that's a good point. And I don't know if it actually checks the schema for some of the predefined schemas at compile. Could even do that, like just quickly check the schema or something like that, and then enforce types at that time or something. Yeah. So definitely something to think about though when you're writing this stuff. I mean, that's the part where you do lose a lot of type safety. So.
Another probably related question. So quite often the data sets, they contain a certain amount of bad data.
Mm-hmm.
So there should be numbers here, but in fact it's garbage.
Uh-huh. I mean, there are ways of, you can go through it and have it look for nulls and all that kind of stuff, and but there's no, I would say, like, there's no built-in method for looking, for dealing with bad records at load time that I know of. And most of the time when you're loading really structured data, it's usually the integrity is already kind of enforced. What we found is that the integrity is already enforced, and that it's usually the unstructured data where you need to do all of that, apply all those criterion, and then there's just a lot of manual code there. But because at that point, if the data table is well defined, then really the only error would be result in like write errors, like actual, you know, something on the order of a hardware error or something. So, but I don't know exactly how you would handle a lot of that stuff. I'm sure it happens, right? So, yeah. So that's a good point. Yeah, I can try to find out a little bit more about that, how it handles read errors. But yeah, this is and it's really great to hear these questions, because this really is probably the most important library to master in Spark. I mean, it just gives you so much more flexibility. We'll jump into Spark ML Lib. If there are, can I answer any more questions on data frames before we move on, or? So Spark, it's the machine learning library. There's actually two. There's one called MLlib, which is the original one, and then there's ML, which is kind of the newer version that leverages the data frames API a little bit more heavily. So the MLlib, there are certain cases where MLlib is still the best call. There's other cases where ML is the best call. Moving forward, ML will eventually be the best library for everything, but there's still some places where MLlib is preferred. So this was really, I mean, this library here, I was really stumping about Spark SQL and how great it is, but that actually came later. That actually came after MLlib. The Spark MLlib was really the whole reason for existing, this whole Spark project, because MLlib requires, you have to solve objective functions to get parameters, and in order to solve an objective function, you have to evaluate it rapidly, which means you have to have an in-memory engine to evaluate. So the whole point of the in-memory and the RDDs and all that stuff was to support machine learning at scale. So this is really the meat and potatoes of Spark. This is the functionality and the value that you'll probably be bringing to your company if you're implementing this. So it's got, you know, pretty much most of the common ones. Anything that, you know, is well understood, is known to scale well, and has good performance is going to be available in MLlib. So we've got, you know, Spark MLlib, and then we've got Spark ML, and we discussed that a little bit. So just want to jump into the K-means demo. And so before I jump into this, how many people are familiar with the K-means algorithm? Okay, great. How many people are familiar with unsupervised learning versus supervised learning? Okay. All right, just very briefly, just so we can get everybody level setted on this, a supervised learning algorithm will take labeled data, will say this data has a set of features, this feature has an associated label with it, like this person has a set of features like his credit score and other things, and the label is whether it's a fraudulent transaction or not, right? And you get a whole bunch of data like that, you train it on the features and the labels, and then you get a new set of features, and it'll say, oh, I predict that this label is there. So that's the supervised learning algorithm. The unsupervised learning algorithm is there's no labels, it's just you're asking the algorithm to find structure in the data itself, meaning these features kind of cluster together in one group of people or one group of things that may or may not be associated with a label that you haven't determined yet. And so that's what the K-means algorithm does. It's a clustering algorithm. It just takes things that are similar in feature space and puts them in clusters. And then at some point you can evaluate those clusters and kind of determine what's going on. I have two clustering algorithms that I wanted to show you. That's why I just want to spend a little bit of time talking about it. So one is a K-means demo. This is the standard one that you will see in most, like, you know, initial studies. And it's pretty much there are two clustering algorithms. And this is a good general purpose one. And then we've got another one that's really good for categorizing text called LDA. But I'll show you the K-means one first. And what was that one under K-means? I think that one is also in Python. So we'll do that. And Spark Home. So sometimes when you're trying to run Spark and PySpark in the same directory, it messes up it creates this thing called a metastore, which is kind of a holdover from the Hive days, and that will mess up your, won't initialize your Spark context properly. So just this weird artifact thing. Okay, so got your Spark context. And then do this exec file. K-means. Okay. So, K-means data. Okay. Okay. So, this is your data here at the top. So these are features. So each row is a feature vector, and this particular set of vectors is really just position vectors. But I mean, vectors can just be a whole series of basically numbers, right? And then you treat them like a vector, and then you find out how close they are in vector space. These are actually, this one here is actually really very closely maps to Cartesian vector space. We've got X, Y, Z, but they don't necessarily have to. You can just have an arbitrary list of numbers and call those features. And then there are no labels here, right? There's just proximity to each other that we're trying to evaluate. That's what k-means is really doing. It just takes those numbers and puts them into clusters. And so you can see we've got 0, 0, 0, 0.1, and 0.2. Gosh, those look like they're going to be close together. And then these look like they're going to be close together, right? So that's the idea. It just takes out clusters. And let me try to remember what these things do. Why is it clusters? I think it's centers, yeah. Okay, so basically we created this cluster object. And those clusters have centers, and those centers are kind of what we thought they were going to be, because this looks like it's the center of this cluster, and those are the center of that cluster, right? So, I mean, this is just small enough so you can do sanity checks on it, right? I mean, this is supposed to be a very large data set, and an arbitrary number of features. But that's the basic idea behind k-means. And that one, I'd say that's the go-to clustering algorithm within Spark for arbitrary features. There's another one called LDA, which is a topic modeling algorithm. Is anybody familiar with this one? Okay, it's the latent Dirichlet allocation algorithm. So we have some examples. So the training on this one, I use the Yahoo news set for this one, which is about 20,000. There is a bit.ly link. Let's see if this thing's broken or not. See what we can do. While we're trying to see if that's broken or not, we can look at the cached version. So what we did is it takes about 20 minutes to train the LDA on this one. And so we don't have, I'm not going to go through the training part of it with you, so we're just going to load a trained model. And this isn't written in Scala, and it's got this visualization package called Brunel. Is anybody familiar with Brunel? Anybody used this before? Okay. Brunel is a pretty nice visualization package. You can run it from within Jupyter. And it's one of the few visualization packages you can run on Scala code. So if you want to visualize your stuff in Scala, this is one way to do it. Otherwise, what you do is you run your workload and then you load it in PySpark and then you do your matplotlib or Bokeh or whatever those visualization packages you like to use. But let's see if this actually came out. Yeah, it looks like. Looks like the live notebook is going to be, oh, no internet. That explains a lot. I just want to see if I can get the live version running. That's a little bit more fun. But I'm okay if we don't. Okay, all right, we have a live version. So this is a notebook. This is basically the IBM version of Jupyter. How many people are familiar with Jupyter? Okay, so this is IBM's hosted notebook. It's called Watson Studio, and it basically it's basically Jupyter at the core with a lot of collaborative stuff added on top of it. It also allows you to run Scala code in Jupyter and plot in Jupyter. So it's pretty nice for a lot of stuff. So there's about, there's 20 categories. This is 20 directories from the Yahoo News Groups. And then we can, this is basically we're loading the pre-trained data here, waiting for the Spark session to start. Basically what I did is I have another notebook that I'm not showing you where I actually loaded the 20 news groups, ran the LDA training, and then spared you the ordeal of waiting 20 minutes for the results. So pull out the pre-cooked version of this, and hopefully maybe it's not even there. I don't know. Let's see. All right, while we're waiting for that, maybe we'll take a look at the Spark session. Okay, so we loaded the data, and now we're going to display the topics and the top 75 words for each topic. So what it does is it takes those news groups, it didn't have any category assigned to it, and it learns topics associated with that those news groups, and then it has a distribution of topics that emit words for each news group. So then you give it a new piece of text, and it says, oh, I think some of it came from this topic, some words came from that topic, some words came from that topic, and hopefully there's one topic that's the dominant topic that'll tell you where most of those words were emitted. So what we're doing here is we're just listing each topic and probability of each and the frequency of each word within each topic. So there's, I think we asked it to compute 10 topics, which is different than the actual data, which were actually 20 topics. So it's printing out all these topics. Let's see how we're doing. Is this thing actually starting? Oh, yeah, I think we did it. Yeah, okay, so I actually got a live version here. Now it's actually printing out those topics. And then we come down here, we do some calculation. And now we're going to pick one of the topics because that's kind of hard to list. And we're going to just do a word cloud and have it display each of those topics. Right? So topic, we just said, oh, let's look at topic 3. This is interactive, right? We're not doing it for all the topics. We're just kind of picking one and exploring. And then we do this Brunel plot. And that'll print out this one here, and it's got Soviet and space, and I think we think that was close to being science and space or something like that. So we said, okay, well, if we see, so that topic that we discovered, we were kind of mapping it onto a topic in the directory in one of the pre-assigned directories. So somebody went through and labeled these emails already, but we didn't have any knowledge of that, so we just tried to come up with new labels for it. And then we're going to, yeah, so this is the same thing here, just showing the same data frame as a data frame rather than as a word cloud. Now we're going to, oh yeah, we said it was science and electronics. That was our thing. So basically now we're going to load that data, and now we're going to make a prediction on an email that came out of that data set and try to reassign that. And so we've got one in here trying to assign a topic to the following text, and so this is the text. And this one came out of the science and electronics thing, so we got rockets and reaction mass, and that sounds like science and electronics or something like that. And now we're going to take that email and we're going to say, okay, now give us the topic distribution. So each topic has a distribution of words, but then each email has a distribution of topics that can emit words, right? So it's this mixture model that we're applying. And so we're saying the first topic distribution, and now we're going to display the topics. And the model says that it is topic 3. Which was the same one that we visualized. So it seems to be mapping. This is all just spot checking. This is not rigorously proven or anything. We're just kind of spot checking in the beginning. This is kind of how you, when you're doing unsupervised learning studies, this is kind of where you start. You try to noodle through the labels, trying to see if they're predictive, if they map to what you think they map to, see if you can take that same data, manually assign labels and create a supervised learning algorithm out of it, right? That would be the next. That would be the next step for that. So. So that's LDA. So those are the two, probably the two big unsupervised learning algorithms. We've got, let's see. All right, so I've got a few things that I can cover. We've got till 1 o'clock. So I've got ML pipelines. I've got another supervised learning model with HART. I've got and probably Spark streaming. What would you guys if let me jump into streaming? Okay, streaming shouldn't take too long, so we'll definitely hit streaming first, and then we'll come back to some of the other ones. And then I've also got GraphX. So let's do Spark streaming, and then we'll come back to the other ones. Okay, and we can also, if we run over time, I can just go through stuff too. I don't know what you guys have going on today, but. So let's do Spark streaming. Spark streaming is basically just a generalization of a Spark workflow. So if you have an RDD, a set of RDD operations, you basically say, okay, I want you just put an egg timer on it and say, okay, I want you to pull data in at this rate. I want you to do calculations at this rate, and then it's suddenly a streaming operation. They call it micro batching. And more recently, they've started to go to event-based streaming, but the concept really pretty much stays the same. So you write your Spark code in your batch version, and then you basically write a streaming version of it. So you have a Spark context, and then you have this other thing called the streaming Spark context, which is SSC, and it's basically the same code with a few extra pieces of metadata to keep track of the streaming part of it. There's another version, I don't have the examples with me today, called structured streaming, which basically is just SQL. So you have your batch SQL operation, and then you just create a streaming version of that. So the places you can pull this data from, I would say, you know, 9 times out of 10 it's Kafka, but you can pull it from ZeroMQ, you can do some other stuff. Yeah, usually it happens with the Kafka side of it. We'll manage like that part of it. You know, you can roll back the logs and do all this other kind of stuff. But for the most part, I mean, it is just a connector to some data source, and it just pulls data off of that. For example, Kafka just pulls data off that log at some interval. And so the part where it manages all of the, you know, the message integrity and all that kind of stuff usually happens before that. So it usually doesn't happen every hour. It's more like seconds or minutes, probably no more than a minute or so, because otherwise you could probably just schedule batch operations. Because it does have kind of a memory constraint, so it can only, you can only manage handle so much data at one time. So usually the time interval is usually tweaked so that, you know, that whatever amount of data it can fit in the memory is optimal. But if you have data that comes in late after the calculation, you probably just append it to the next batch or something like that, right? I mean, most of the time it really is just a timer, and it just pulls data off of, you know, whatever fire hose it has connected to at the time, and then just crunches through the data that it has. There are fancier ways of dealing with the messaging, but I haven't really looked into it recently. I think it has come a long way since the last time I've worked with it, so I can check on it for you and find out a little bit more. Is there a specific use case that you have in mind, or?
Well, when we see streaming, we usually do like user sessions, for example, and so we, like, a user session will close with no activity for, you know, 30 minutes or so.
Okay.
If some of that data comes in late, then the user session will be broken.
Oh, okay. Yeah. I think there probably have to be some additional bookkeeping on things like that. I mean, yeah, what this does really is it has a timer. It basically puts a timer on it and just pulls data as it gets it. But you could somehow account for that in the calculation, like the state of the user session and whether there's more data and whether you need to aggregate to the previous session and things like that. But you could add logic to do that. It just wouldn't be built into it. So it wouldn't be too hard to add that, I don't think. But yeah, let me just show you a previous, just a very quick demo on how this looks. This is your, so now you're creating a, now you're creating a new streaming context. So this is yet another context that you have to create. Now this lines is going to come from this from localhost port 9999, and this old school netcat thing. We'll open up port 999, and we can send text through it. And then we're going to take the words. We're going to do a flat map and split them. And we're going to do a word count. So those of you from MapReduce universe will recognize this sort of familiar tuple where you just turn the word count and the token and a comma one, and then you just reduce by key, where you take this one and you reduce it to all the ones that have the same key, and then add up the numbers in the second column, and then that gives you your word count, right? Is that a familiar algorithm? So this is a classic word count. This is what it looks like in Spark. And then we're going to print the words, and we're going to print the word counts. And we're not going to start the streaming context here. So we'll run the code, we'll define the context, and then we'll launch it with sse.start. And that'll start the streaming context, okay? So this looks, 99% of this looks just like normal Spark code, right? Almost everything here could be done with it without being in a streaming context. So that's what's nice about it, right? It's even if like this isn't your streaming application at the end of the day, it's the one that'll maybe get you to define, making your problem definition more concrete, and then you can decide whether you want to continue here or you want to try to use some fancier stuff. So we'll go ahead and load. I think it's is that what it's called? Simple stream demo. Dope. Simple stream. So I'm going to change this if you guys want to know how that happened. But okay, so we loaded the code. It created this all these objects. These are all just ready to get started. And then we just do this nc-lk 9999, and then we'll do ssc start. Okay, now it's reporting the time, and if it shows up it shows up in that micro batch, whether it's on the same line or not, it will count it. If it shows up on the same line, it'll always count it, but if you show it on a different line, it'll have this window batching, and so okay, so that'll just tell you, however many I can only type so fast, so okay. So that's the basic, it's just your simple word count, but this is the basic idea. Normally, you're going to be pulling from the other good place to start is if you don't want to have this this kind of thing. You can start with a Kafka log, and the reason this is really not set up to run from Spark Shell. I mean, you can rig it to run from Spark Shell, but it's kind of hard to run it from Spark. Most of the time you compile it and you run it, but if you disable the logging on this, you can get it to work from Spark Shell and get a basic prototype going. But so if you make sure you set the log level to error, that otherwise you'll get so much logging every time you run this that you won't be able to see the output. So and then we'll do sysexit. Yeah, see, it doesn't really like to stop. So just a heads up. I mean, this is it's really pushing limits on the Spark Shell. But, huh? What's that? Yeah. It groans a lot when you try to do it this way. But it's a quick way to see what it can do. And you can't really do it in notebooks. You can do it if you've ever used Zeppelin. Anybody ever use the Zeppelin notebooks? You can run streaming from within Zeppelin. Jupyter is not so great with running streaming, but Zeppelin's okay. And then, so that's that. Now we're close to 1 o'clock, but I can keep going. How many people need to leave at 1? Okay, yeah, no problem. I'll just give a quick thank you slide, and then we can jump into more examples if you guys want to fiddle around for a little while. So if you guys have any questions, give me a buzz at the email or my Twitter handle or LinkedIn. Happy to answer any questions about Spark. And thanks for coming out. Really appreciate it.
Thank you.